Rising unemployment led to widespread panic and a run on the banks. But in the midst of this crisis, one man emerged, promising the country a new deal.
Change. Change. And party leadership does not strike at the fundamental principles of the Republic. On the contrary, it gives opportunity to strip from those fundamentals of the fathers the weeds and the noxious vines that today obscure the simplicity and the cleanliness of its original outline. If you believe in that new deal that I believe in, you will have done your part towards the restoration of the purity and the success of representative government throughout the land. We face that crisis. We face it with singleness of purpose and, above all, with faith. Keep that faith constant. Keep that faith high. So shall we win through to a better day.
Election night proved how badly Americans wanted change. As crowds of people gathered at the Biltmore, Roosevelt learned that he had pulled ahead of Herbert Hoover by more than 7 million votes. By midnight, he could say,
"It looks, my friends, like a real landslide this time."
Inauguration Day, March 4th, 1933. Outgoing President Herbert Hoover was subdued as he and his wife took leave of the White House. For the 4 months between the election in November and the inauguration in March, he had been a lame duck president, frustrated by his inability to solve the nation's economic problems. The slow ride from the White House to the Capitol was punctuated by long, chilled silences in the presidential car. Though their campaign rivalry was long past, Franklin Roosevelt's refusal to support Hoover's policies during his final months in office had deeply offended the retiring president. Roosevelt would take responsibility only when he took power, and finally, that moment had arrived. Yards from the east door of the Capitol to the rostrum, wearing steel braces and leaning on the arm of his son James, Franklin Delano Roosevelt moved with slow dignity toward the spot where Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes would administer the presidential oath. Was expectant as the man they had chosen to lead them out of the Depression recited the oath of office.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
In the first so-called 100 days of his administration, Roosevelt managed to get Congress to pass 15 major laws, a remarkable achievement. These laws provided the groundwork for his New Deal recovery plan aimed at revitalizing the U.S. economy. And over the next 5 years, the Roosevelt administration poured millions of government dollars into public works and conservation projects. Established industry codes for hours and wages, and set up a social security system for the elderly, the unemployed, and the handicapped. Faced with a national crisis, Roosevelt had acted boldly and confidently. But by 1939, the question was, could he handle a crisis of international proportions? In Germany, Adolf Hitler and his Nazi party had seized control, and in defiance of the Versailles Treaty, they had rebuilt Germany's military forces. By 1936, Hitler could look down proudly on an army that had already reoccupied the Rhineland and was soon to threaten the borders of half the nations of Europe. President Roosevelt believed that where democracy failed, dictatorship triumphed, and a German people divided and weary of weak leaders and economic crisis proved the thesis and succumbed to the voice of a fanatic. In all the troubled nations of Europe, it was the decade of the dictator. In Italy, too, a dictator's ambition would soon inspire the annexation of Ethiopia and the proud title of the new Caesar for Benito Mussolini. But in the U.S., Ethiopia seemed very far away. Daily life went on as usual.
Well, I'm going to do a good job this year.
Try hard.
Which camera do you want me to break?
At the outset of the war, few Americans favored intervention. The baseball field was far more attractive than the battlefield, particularly when the exciting rookie Joe DiMaggio was at bat. By 1937, Franklin D. Roosevelt's role as a peacetime president was reshaped by outside events. Japan had netted Manchuria and invaded China. Hitler sounded the old cry of German expansion. The president's problem was to persuade a recalcitrant Congress and a reluctant public of the need to rebuild American defenses and prepare for the dangers posed by the turmoil in world affairs.
Well, anyway, I wish you'd had the chance that I had to get away for 2 weeks, because I did have a wonderful holiday. And I've come back with all sorts of new lessons, which I learned from barracuda and sharks. I'm a tough guy.
In Spain, two philosophies of imperialism and violence met head-on. Rampant nationalism forged an army revolt against the communist-infiltrated government. The result? General civil war. The loyalists, supporters of the elected left-wing government, found new allies and new enemies other than the fascist armies of Generalissimo Francisco Franco. Spain became the testing ground for the new war machines and tactics of Moscow, Rome, and Berlin.
Without a declaration of war, and without warning or justification of any kind, civilians, including vast numbers of women and children, are being ruthlessly murdered with bombs from the air. If those things come to pass in other parts of the world, let no one imagine that America will escape, that America may expect mercy, that this Western Hemisphere will not be attacked. It is my determination to pursue a policy of peace. It is my determination to adopt every practicable measure to avoid involvement in war.
Roosevelt proposed quarantine for the aggressors, a call lost in the chorus of Hitler's massive rebuilding of German military might. From 1936 to 39, the Third Reich steadily rose from a demilitarized nation to become the armed giant of Europe. Concentrated on rebuilding its military, the United States was occupied with far more peaceful pursuits, like this public works project in Oregon.
As I look on Bonneville Dam today, I cannot help the thought that instead of spending, as some nations do, half their national income in piling up armaments and more armaments for purposes of war, we in America are wiser in using our wealth on projects like this, which will give us more wealth, better living, and greater happiness for our children.
British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain still believed that treaties brought peace. By signing the Munich Pact, he paid Hitler's price for peace in our time, Czechoslovakia.
We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
It proved a bad bargain. Within less than a year, on September 1, 1939, Nazi armies attacked Poland. 2 days later, France and England reluctantly declared war on Germany. Warsaw was demolished by the terrifying new Nazi air assault techniques. Advancing rapidly, Hitler's blitzkrieg met the Russian armies in the middle of Poland. This had been prearranged a month earlier when Molotov and Ribbentrop signed a non-aggression pact. Now, the world learned the real purpose of that secret pact, the partition of Poland. As the world watched Poland disappear, Franklin Roosevelt warned America that when the peace was broken anywhere, the U.S. was in danger.
This nation will remain a neutral nation, but I cannot ask that every American remain neutral in thought as well. Even a neutral has a right to take account of facts. Even a neutral cannot be asked to close his mind or to close his conscience. I have said not once but many times that I have seen war and that I hate war. I say that again and again. I hope the United States will keep out of this war. I believe that it will. And I give you assurance and reassurance that every effort of your government will be directed toward that end.
For Franklin Roosevelt, the clamorous world situation was a lever to shift American arms production into high gear and to shape U.S. policy to aid England and France. Attacking first things first, the president branded the Embargo Act of 1935 a mistake. The Roosevelt thesis, since the act had forbidden the U.S. to sell arms, American industry was not geared to substantial arms production, and the nation was vulnerable to aggression. Calling Congress into special session on September 21st, FDR called for rapid military buildup and authority to sell belligerents U.S. arms on a cash-and-carry basis.
I give to you my deep and unalterable conviction, based on years of experience as a worker in the field of international peace, that by the repeal of the embargo, the United States will more probably remain at peace than if the law remains as it stands today. These perilous days demand cooperation between us, without a trace of partisanship. Our acts must be guided by one single hard-headed thought, keeping America out of this war.
The president's plan drew support, but some congressmen argued that cash and carry meant favoring naval powers like England over the Axis land powers. It meant taking sides. Isolation was still the only answer to men like Idaho's Senator Borah.
I would not furnish munitions to any nation engaged in war.
Hiram Johnson gave warning.
Many of us believe we're being eased into war by the repeal of the embargo. We are unalterably opposed. Great profits are at stake on one side, the lives of our loved ones on the other. Americans be on guard. We want no war. We can and should keep out.
The Republicans were confident they had more than the third term issue. They had found a dynamic candidate in Wendell Willkie, and they were convinced Willkie had the issues, the myth of the indispensable man, and America's desire to stay out of the war.
One man rule is always fatal to democracy. And let me tell you something else that one man rule always leads to. It always leads to the road to war.
Tonight, there is one more false charge, one outrageously false charge that has been made to strike terror into the hearts of our citizens. It is a charge that offends every political and religious conviction that I hold dear. It is the charge that this administration wishes to lead this country into war. That charge is contrary to every fact, every purpose of the past 8 years. Throughout these years, my every act and thought has been directed to the end of preserving the peace of the world, and more particularly, the peace of the United States, the peace of the Western Hemisphere.
His promise to keep our boys out of foreign wars is no better than his promise to balance the budget. They're already almost on the transport.
I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign war.
This administration cannot bring us domestic prosperity. It cannot build us a defense. It cannot unify us. I call upon you to elect a Republican administration in this year, 1940.
I remind you, when the naval expansion bill came up in 1938, the vast majority of Republican members of the Congress voted against building any more battleships. What kind of political shenanigans are those? Can such people be treated, trusted with national defense? I say no.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
With those words, Franklin Roosevelt became the only man in history to be 3 times inaugurated President of the United States of America.
In Washington's day, the task of the people was to create and weld together a nation. In Lincoln's day, the task of the people was to preserve that nation
from disruption from within. In this day, the task of the people is to save that nation and its institutions from disruption from without. In the face of great perils never before encountered, our strong purpose is to protect and to perpetuate the integrity of democracy.
By 1941, the fate of democracy in Europe hung on the slender thread of England's refusal to accept defeat. The fall of France had stunned the world, and now the Nazis were intent on bombing England into submission. But months of brutal attacks by the German Luftwaffe failed to drive the Royal Air Force from the skies or break the spirit of the British civilians. Prime Minister Winston Churchill never gave up hope that the U.S. would enter the war. Roosevelt was sympathetic, and short of entering the war, he tried to help the Allies with supplies and armaments.
To all the states and nations, bond or free. To all the men in all the lands who care for freedom's cause. To all our allies and well-wishers in Europe. To our American friends and helpers, drawing ever closer in their might across the ocean. This is the message. Lift up your hearts. All will come right out of the depths of sorrow and of sacrifice. Will be born again the glory of mankind.
Let us say to the democracies, we Americans are vitally concerned in your defense of freedom. We are putting forth our energies, our resources, and our organizing powers to give you the strength to regain and maintain a free world. We shall send you in ever-increasing numbers ships, planes, tanks, guns. That is our purpose and our pledge.
To many, FDR's lend-lease policy marked the end of U.S. neutrality. Some senators, like Burton K. Wheeler, were strongly opposed.
Translation of the lend-lease policy into legislative form has stunned a Congress fully sympathetic to the British cause. It warranted my worst fears for the future of America, and it definitely stamps the president as war-minded.
But support was growing in both parties.
Our greatest problem, and my sincere hope, is not alone to keep America out of war, but to keep war out of America. However, in such dire circumstances as the democratic world faces today, it's necessary to give our elected executive extraordinary powers. Democracy cannot hope to survive against aggression in any other way.
Congress acted, and desperately needed supplies were en route to England immediately. In 1940, FDR had set production goals for 50,000 aircraft. Meeting these quotas boosted employment and helped revitalize the U.S. economy. Critics charged the president with solving his economic problems by creating his own emergency, his own war. On August 12th, off the coast of Newfoundland, a British warship served as a meeting place for the two remaining leaders of the free world. The Germans were on the offensive in North Africa and had invaded Russia. Nazi submarines were sinking one out of three Allied cargo ships. Roosevelt and Churchill met to discuss joint strategy. This meeting made America's position clear.
Oh, this meeting came a statement that would become known as the Atlantic Charter. It stated that, after the final destruction of the Nazi tyranny, we hope to see established a peace which will afford to all nations a means of dwelling in safety and which will afford assurance that all the men in all the lands may live out their lives in freedom from fear and want. November 1941, and President Roosevelt, preparing a nation for the dangers of war, found some rest in Warm Springs, Georgia.
Russell, this is going to be a grand Thanksgiving party, and we're going to have a very big turkey, and there's going to be very little left of him when we get through. This is a very good turkey. Will you have light or dark or both? Both. That's grand.
Throughout the summer and fall of 1941, Japanese and American diplomats held talks to try and preserve peace between the two countries.
As a diplomat, I cannot say much, but Japan and the United States have a common responsibility to maintain and develop the peace in the Pacific.
In November, Special Envoy Kurusu revealed that Japan's price for peace was a free hand in the Pacific. Secretary of State Hull and Roosevelt rejected this. The talks continued into December. At 6 a.m. Hawaiian time on the morning of December 7th, 1941, the first of nearly 200 Japanese aircraft took off from carriers located off the Hawaiian Islands. Their destination? Wheeler Airfield, Hickam Field, and Pearl Harbor. Within 15 minutes, the battleship line of the U.S. Pacific Fleet had been destroyed.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
Pearl Harbor ended further debate over entering the war. The president addressed a united America.
We must be set to face a long war against crafty and powerful bandits. The attack at Pearl Harbor can be repeated at any one of many points in both oceans and along both our coastlines and against all the rest of the hemisphere. It will not only be a long war, it will be a hard war. We expect to eliminate the danger from Japan, but it would serve us ill if we accomplished that and found that the rest of the world was dominated by Hitler and Mussolini. We are going to win this war, and we are going to win the peace that follows.
In 1943, America's war production began to meet the minimum needs of an offensive global war. U.S. bomber forces, including the new B-25s, were hitting the enemy wherever it could be reached. Colonel Doolittle's bombing mission on Tokyo had shown the Japanese that their homeland was not safe from air attacks. And Germany had a first taste of what she had tried to give England, saturation bombing.
Hitler and Mussolini, they will understand now the enormity of their miscalculation, that the Nazis would always have the advantage of superior air power, as they did when they bombed Warsaw and Rotterdam and London and Coventry. That superiority has gone forever. Yes. We believe that the Nazis and the fascists have asked for it, and they're going to get it. I do not prophesy when this war will end, but I do believe that this year of 1943 will give to the United Nations a very substantial advance along the roads that lead to Berlin and Rome and Tokyo.
At Casablanca in January 1943, Allied leaders met and President Roosevelt arranged an uneasy truce between Generals Giraud and de Gaulle to unite the free French forces. Still more important was the agreement on unconditional surrender by the Axis. 10 months later, another grueling conference at Cairo, this time with Chiang Kai-shek. Axis propagandists had been predicting that the U.S. and England would eventually turn on the Soviet Union and China. Churchill and Roosevelt confirmed the alliance not only for victory, but for the peace to come. But it was at Tehran that the greatest concentration of world power in history took place. Franklin Roosevelt had made the long, exhausting voyage to come face to face with Joseph Stalin. This was the man with whom he must come to grips if victory was to lead to peace. Out of the Tehran conference came the final decision that would lead to victory in Europe. The second front, for which the Russians had so long pleaded, was built step by step. General Mark Clark had led an invasion force into Italy at Salerno in September, attacking what Churchill called the soft underbelly of the Axis. But FDR knew that the greatest challenge was ahead. Grimly, he began planning with General Eisenhower the invasion of France. June 6th, 1944, D-Day.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. Thy will be done, Almighty God.
It is the overwhelming desire of this convention to nominate a great, a grand, a vigorous a fighting young American, the noble, the dramatic, and the appealing governor of the great state of New York, Thomas E. Dewey.
Ohio Governor John Bricker offered Thomas E. Dewey the unenviable task of opposing the nation's commander-in-chief in time of war. There was little to attack but the fourth term itself.
Everywhere, from coast to coast, the American people are coming to the decision that it's time for a change.
To put to rest rumors of failing health, FDR rode 56 miles through a freezing rain in an open car. Again, Franklin Roosevelt proved a wily campaigner.
These Republican leaders have not been content with attacks on me, or on my wife, or on my sons. No, not content with that. They now include my little dog, Fallon. Well, of course, I don't resent attacks. And my family don't resent attacks. But Fallon does resent it. You know, Fallon's Scotch. And being a Scotty, as soon as he learned that the Republican fiction writers, in Congress and out, had concocted a story that I'd left him behind on an Aleutian island and had sent a destroyer back to find him, at a cost to the taxpayers of $2 or $3 or $8 or $20 million, his Scotch soul was furious.
In 1944, Franklin Roosevelt won a fourth term as president, carrying 36 states. With newly elected Vice President Harry Truman, he was eager to bring the war to a close. In Europe, the Allies were closing in. Soviet armies were pushing into Middle Europe and liberating a Poland that they'd helped conquer 4 years before. The German army, battered by a three-way offensive and constant attack from the air, was in retreat. And in Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Yugoslavia, the Soviet armies were advancing relentlessly as the Nazi puppet governments crumbled. On the Western Front, Allied armies broke through the Franco-German border and pushed up through Italy toward the Alps. The key to victory was proving to be supplies, the secret weapon, American production. Hitler's dream of building a German Reich that, as he said, would last 1,000 years, had failed. Roosevelt and Churchill prepared for war's aftermath, mindful of a victory 25 years earlier that had turned its back on peace. On February 3rd, 1945, at Yalta, they met again with the one other man who could make that peace possible. Without Stalin's cooperation, FDR could not gain his two main objectives, Soviet entry into the war against Japan and Soviet participation in a world peace organization. Roosevelt saw himself as a mediator between British colonialism and Soviet communist expansion. Throughout the long, tedious conference, he fought for unity and emerged with both of his major goals. Germany was to be removed as a threat to Europe, and the United Nations would become a reality. He returned to report to the American people, convinced that his hard work had gained some valuable concessions. He seemed tired, but hopeful.
I hope that you will pardon me for an unusual posture of sitting down during the presentation of what I want to say. I know that you will realize that it makes it a lot easier for me in not having to carry about 10 pounds of steel round on the bottom of my legs, and also because of the fact that I have just completed a 14,000-mile trip. First of all, I want to say it's good to be home. I'm returning from this trip that took me so far refreshed and inspired. I was well the entire time. I did not, I was not ill for a second until I arrived back in Washington. And there I heard all of the rumors which had occurred in my absence. Yes, I returned from the trip refreshed and inspired. The Roosevelts are not, as you may suspect, averse to travel. We seem to thrive on it. I come from the Crimea Conference with a firm belief that we have made a good start on the road to a world of peace. And I am confident that the Congress and the American people will accept the results of this conference as the beginnings of a permanent structure of peace upon which we can begin to build, under God, that better world in which our children and grandchildren, yours and mine, the children and grandchildren of the whole world, must live and can live. And that, my friends, is the only message I can give you, but I feel it very deeply, as I know that all of you are feeling it today and are going to feel it in the future.
Following the Yalta Conference, Franklin Roosevelt, who was resting at his summer home in Warm Springs, Georgia, died of a cerebral hemorrhage. The date was April 12, 1945. No president since Lincoln was mourned as deeply as Franklin Roosevelt. As his funeral train made its way to Washington and then to Hyde Park, thousands of people crowded along the route, waiting long hours to get a glimpse of the train and pay their last respects. All around the world, the news of FDR's death came as a shock. American Marines and servicemen still fighting in places like Okinawa and Berlin were deeply distressed at the loss of their commander-in-chief. In London, at about midnight, an aide broke the news to Prime Minister Churchill, who would later write, "I felt as if I had been struck a physical blow." Vice President Harry Truman was no less stunned, for now he would have to finish the war, a war that Roosevelt believed had been necessary to safeguard democracy.
The issue of this war is the basic issue between those who believe in mankind and those who do not. The ancient issue between those who put their faith in the people and those who put their faith in dictators and tyrants. There have always been those who did not believe in the people, who attempted to block their forward movement across history, to force them back to servility and suffering and silence. The people have now gathered their strength. They are moving forward in their might and power, and no force, no combination of forces, no trickery, deceit or violence can stop them now. They see before them the hope of the world, a decent, secure, peaceful, light for men everywhere.
The collapse of Germany came less than a month after Franklin Roosevelt's death. Though he would miss the war's end, it was clear from a speech he was drafting the day before he died that FDR was already looking ahead. He wrote, "The only limit to our realization of tomorrow will be our doubts of today. Let us move forward with strong and active faith."